My Mac Magazine podcast number 190, A Marriage of Mediocrity, with Sam Levin, David Cohen, and me, Tim Robertson.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com podcast.
And I am Tim Robertson, and we're joined right at the beginning of the show this week with Sam Levin. Hello, Sam Levin.
Hello there, Tim.
Cool Mac Picks. You've been absent last week. You were in Barcelona. How was your trip?
I was in Barcelona, Barcelona. It was fantastic. The Spanish people are wonderful. I met a number of people. I went for the Digital Music 2.0 conference I spoke at, and talked about social media tools and what people are using in the digital space to market their wares and tares, and specifically targeting, you know, what musicians are doing. But I said, guys, it's not just about musicians, it's about anyone nowadays.
Yeah, definitely.
Marketing anything. But musicians, more than ever, need to get on the ball, especially online. They're about 2 years behind United States when it comes to, you know, marketing
online. In Spain, you mean?
In Spain. But they might be behind us that way, but they're so rich in culture. It's a great, great place to visit, and it's right on the ocean. It's just beautiful.
Well, glad you had a good time.
Yep.
And did you drink a lot?
Not a huge amount, but I got to drink sangrias and some great Rioja red wine, and that's, you know, they make great wine in Spain. So I drank enough, but I absorbed everything else, pictures. I'll send you the photo log. It's beautiful.
Cool. So what do you got for us this week, Sam?
All right. Now, for Cool Mac Picks today, I decided that we'd talk about something very cool. It's called MyView. That's MyVU. So if you go to myvu.com, you'll see their, I call them heads-up displays for, you know, they're like sunglasses, except they're miniature TV monitors inside of these. So the one that I've been testing and I just started yesterday is called the MyView Crystal. And it's pretty remarkable, guys. This is specifically developed for the iPod. It'll work with the 5G iPod. It will work with the new generation of iPods, the third gen Nano, the Classic, the iPod Touch. I haven't tried the iPhone yet. I'm going to try that probably in the next few days. But basically, you've seen these, you know, displays that people wear, and it used to be very futuristic. Well, now you can buy one of these MyView crystals and plug it into your iPod and watch movies or, you know, anything that's viewable on your iPod video till the cows come home. It's really well done.
Is it comfortable to wear them?
It's comfortable. It's definitely comfortable. For a couple reasons, they make the nose piece adjustable. It's very soft, malleable plastic or acrylic. And then the earbuds are made by Ultimate Ears. And if anyone knows Ultimate Ears, they develop their ear headphones or earbuds for rock stars. And they develop really expensive versions for rock stars. They're sound isolation, bass-enhanced earbuds. They're very comfortable. I know that, Tim, you're not into earbuds, but these are comfortable. And you really have to have earbuds because you need to be able to adjust them any which way. The whole thing collapses. You know, it folds into a small area. You could power your iPod with a mini USB. There's a mini USB port on the back of the unit. The unit has this kind of a remote that you can change the contrast of the lighting or the volume. So once you plug it into the iPod, you select whatever you're looking at, whether it's slideshow or movies, and you hit play, you don't need to touch the iPod again.
Wow, cool.
They make three different models from MyView. They make, the Crystal, they make the Shades, and they make the Solo Plus. And they're all different, and some of them have higher resolution. This one has 640 by 480 VGA quality. It's $299, and
how big is the screen when you have them on? I mean, does it feel like you're in a movie theater or watching your TV?
No,
or?
I would say TV, yes. Movie theater, no. It's you know, I have not used it for extended period because, as I said, I just tried it for the last 24 hours. But I tried their original ones, and their original ones were really good. And I think they've improved on the quality of the audio. So I'll tell you in the next 2 weeks. Give me a couple weeks because I would like to watch an entire movie. I have I Am Legend on there. I've got a bunch of real first-rate movies. I've got some comedy stuff. So I'm going to look at stuff that I've ripped to stuff that I've actually bought and purchased from iTunes Movies or the music store. So I'm going to test it on all sorts of different genres. And
what do you think the demographic for this is, Sam? I can't imagine using this at home if you have your TV. You're not going to do it driving, obviously, but I would imagine someone that commutes to work on a bus or a train or carpools.
It could be that. It's someone that's a traveler. I think someone that is traveling and, like, you know, if I had this packed it with me, I would have considered it. I think someone that is a traveler and has, you know, the discretionary income to spend, you know, it's not real cheap.
It's not cheap, yeah, definitely.
It's not cheap, but on the other hand, people are spending a lot of money on earphones. I mean, they're spending well over $100. I mean, look at, you know, Bose. They have their isolation or noise cancellation headphones.
And they're not cheap, yeah.
They're not cheap at all. They're probably $200.
Yep.
So people are already spending that on earphones. So, and you see that on airplanes. People are carrying them all over the place. So if they're spending that, well, wouldn't it be cool to have this and, you know, a device to watch your movies? Because when I flew on this plane, it was this old Air France 747, and it didn't have personal viewing screens.
Oh,
so
yeah.
This would have been perfect for the transcontinental flight. So I think for the traveler, it's perfect. Or if you want to give a gift to someone that has, you know, anything, this is a great, great gift.
So give us an update in a couple weeks. Let us know how you like it, whether the listeners should definitely look at investing in one or maybe not.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely, I will. And so the next thing I want to talk to you about, and speaking about, you know, the connection with Barcelona, is a website. Now, it's called Partners in Rhyme. Exactly the way it's spelled, partnersinrhyme.com. They are a company that offers royalty-free music and sound effects. And it's all online. You can peruse through a multitude of genres, from rock to ambient to chill, world, jazz.
Just music either. They have everyday sounds.
They have a whole CD just for dogs.
Yeah.
It's a dog CD. So if you're into, for whatever reason, you need some dog sounds. They've got, you know,
to drive your cats crazy.
Exactly. That would be cool. They've got, you know, I've been listening to a bunch of their chill sound stuff or their ambient music. And if you just go to Partners in Rhyme, you'll see it. I mentioned this for a couple reasons. The co-founders, Mark and Mona Lea, were at the conference. So
I actually talked to Mark online via Skype, thanks to you, yesterday. And
right.
Really nice guy. Really nice. And I was telling him how, because we're recording this podcast a day later than usual, is because my four-year-old got sick right before my wife was supposed to leave with the kids so we could record the podcast.
Right.
Inconvenience, but I'd rather her get sick, you know, here at home than in the car, especially because I have a brand new car.
Okay.
And so I still had Skype running. He came up on Skype, thanks to an introduction through you, and I was chatting with him a little bit, and I was telling him, you know, my daughter got sick, and she's kind of, you know, in the bathroom, throwing up in the background, and he said, yeah, he knows how that is. His wife had actually got sick a couple years ago, really bad for a couple weeks, and they recorded her getting sick.
Oh, my God.
And it's one of their best sellers.
Oh, my gosh. So
I think that's great. That's just fantastic.
This is how creative they are. You know, they're the dynamic duo. He carries around a really high-quality portable mic that, you know, records onto, you know, whatever, solid state or built-in memory. He walks around the city. So he records, you name it, and then he mixes it. He's got a whole studio at his place in Barcelona. I actually saw it. And he's got Pro Tools. He records it. And then he's able to either give it away online, because they do offer free music loops that you could check out, or offers it for sale. And one of my favorites is Groove Salad. Check out the under the ambient chill area. It's called Groove Salad. So that's one of my favorite, where I could use as a background sound for movies or anything that you're doing. So I already created a slideshow with iPhoto and used the Groove Salad theme. And plus, they have a number of other different sites. If you go to musicloops.com, that is part of Partners in Rhyme as well. But it's just a very, very cool business that they've done, and they're able
to
do it.
They're not new to this either. They've been doing this almost as long as I've been doing MyMac.com. They've been doing this since 1995, same year that we started.
Yep, they've been around for a while. He's no stranger to this, and so is Mona Lea. And she has her own, you know, blog. They've been doing this for many, many years. If you go check out his name in imdb.com, you know, the movie database, go see. I'm not going to tell you guys. Find out about Mark Lewis. You're going to be very surprised who he is. And then in 1 or 2 weeks, when we come back, we'll see what people have, what you find out about Mark Lewis. He's well known in the movie business.
Awesome.
So those are the couple things that I wanted to talk to you about under Cool Mac Picks, and there's so much more, but we just don't have all that time. But so one of them is MyView. So go to MyView.com with their cool movie glasses, and the other is PartnersInRhyme.com.
Thanks, Sam.
Absolutely. Have fun, guys.
And I'm joined by David Cohen. Hello, David.
Hi, Tim.
It's kind of a fun day for me yesterday when we were supposed to do the podcast and I had a sick child, but hey, we're here a day later, right?
That's right, yeah.
So today I took the previously sick child, the 4-year-old, to see a movie, and we went and saw Wall-E from Pixar. And I got to say,
I'm looking forward to seeing that.
You know what? I really enjoyed it. It was a great movie. I don't think it's Pixar's best. I would probably rank it within the top five. I don't think it's as good as either one of the Toy Stories or Finding Nemo or The Incredibles. But I do think it was better than, say, Bug's Life or Ratatouille. So take that for whatever it's worth. I liked it. My daughter liked it all day long since we saw the movie. And actually before, she's walking around the house going, Wall-E! You know. So she, you know, she's a kid. She loves the robots. It's a good story. But there's actually some Apple connection in that movie.
Well, you would expect it, really. Obviously, Pixar and you know, the Steve Jobs connection is now closer than it ever has been before.
Yep.
So you know, it's nice to see they're putting the odd references to the boss in.
Well, the iPod's in there, an iPod video that plays kind of a prominent role in the movie. And then when Wally's batteries go down and he has to recharge, the sound that he makes when he's done recharging is the Macintosh startup chime. Boing. And I loved it. And of course, I was the only person who laughed at that. I was like, aha!
But the thing is, don't you think that sort of, I mean, obviously the startup chime is kind of a homage thing, but putting an iPod in there, don't you think that sort of intelligent product placement is better in movies than, you know, some of these big blockbusters where kind of, you know, the action gets pushed to one side while they make sure
you
get to see it.
Coca-Cola now.
I saw a movie about 2-3 years ago. It was called The Island with Hugh McGregor in, and the product placement was just, you know, they were literally putting beer bottles down in front of the camera and having conversations behind them.
Yes.
The product placement was so intense, and it was just ridiculous.
Yep, I remember that movie. I don't remember any particular product, so I think they probably failed in that regard. But I do remember finishing watching that movie and went, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's 2 hours I'm not going to get back.
Yeah.
So if anybody's looking to see Wall-E anytime in the future, you got my recommendation. It's definitely worth the exorbitant rates that the movie theaters charge nowadays, it's worth it.
It's interesting, actually. We've been, obviously, you know, we're deep in the blockbuster season now, and
this is the first one I've seen this year, by the way.
Yeah, well, we've seen a couple, but my wife and I have actually, you know, we are actually now looking at the movies that we're seeing trailers for. We watch all the trailers on the Apple TV.
Yep, so do we.
And we are actually deciding that one. No, we're not going to go to the theater to see. We'd rather see it at home, and we'll wait for it to come out for rental on iTunes, and we'll watch it that way. Purely because, you know, some of them we think it's just we haven't got time to go and see all of them, and we can wait for a few. And others we think we'll probably enjoy it more watching it at home than going to a theater.
Yeah, I'm with you there. In fact, I think I like any movie watching it at home more than a theater. But there are some films, I think, that like The Hulk or The Transformers, that's just huge, and you really don't get the experience unless you see it in a theater. Although,
yeah,
with Transformers, I don't think it really matters where you see it because it was horrible no matter what. but The Hulk, the new Hulk movie, I'm dying to see. You know, I've been a comic book collector, or reader, I should say. I don't collect them anymore. I just read them. Since I was, 7 or 8 years old.
Yeah.
And this is the first summer that they've had a number of superhero movies that I haven't gone and seen. You know, I haven't seen Iron Man yet. I know everything that happens in the movie, but I haven't seen the actual movie.
Yeah.
Haven't seen, what's the other? I know The Hulk, and there was another superhero movie that was just out too.
Wanted. That's a comic book movie.
Yeah, but that's not really a superhero. There was another superhero movie though. And it's
Hancock.
I'm supposed to take Brittany to that next weekend. She wants to take some of her friends. Obviously, they need a parent chaperone, so I've elected myself to go because I want to see Hancock. Hancock looks like one of those movies that's going to be quite enjoyable.
I think so. And there's, well, Batman's out last year in the summer.
Yes, Batman is another one. So there's a lot of movies out there that I haven't seen, but if you ask me, WALL-E with the Apple connection, I mean, anybody that's an Apple fan is going to pick it up right away, even without listening to this podcast. They're going to get a kick out of it. So that's kind of neat.
Excellent.
Also today, as we record this, is Friday. It's kind of a historic event for Microsoft. And that is, and not just Microsoft, but the entire technology community. Today is Bill Gates' last day at Microsoft. And I think that's historic. And of course, you know, as Mac users, everybody wants to go boo hiss. But Microsoft has played a very, very, very prominent role in Apple history, probably more important than any other company other than Apple themselves.
Well, I mean, you've got to remember that in the early days of Microsoft, if the IBM PC hadn't come along, then you know, Bill Gates was trying to convince Apple to effectively embrace and sort of join together so that Apple would be the primary platform that Microsoft software ran on.
Yes.
And so, you know, if that had happened, then obviously we would probably not have, we certainly wouldn't, I wouldn't imagine we'd have OS X in the form we have it today. We'd have something very different. We'd have Absolutely. Something that probably looks more like Windows.
And one of the things that I'd like to find out from you, David, how much of an impact do you think Bill Gates leaving Microsoft is really going to have on them?
Well, you know, I've been reading quite a few of the articles online about the history of what he's been doing at Microsoft, and particularly more recently. And I'd only had a peripheral interest in that of late. But I think actually he's not. I mean, he's not been close to the company for a long time. He's very much into this charitable work he's doing, which he's doing amazing things with. And he's only really been working sort of 1-2 days a week at Microsoft anyway, in a role that was created for him. It was chief software architect. So it's not really a hands-on operational day-to-day role. And it's been interesting reading this week about some of the memos he's sent out over the last few years complaining about problems he's found in Microsoft products. And apparently he's famous for issuing these scathing reviews of Microsoft products.
They obviously didn't listen to him a lot of the times, unfortunately.
Well, I think what happens is he reviews these things after the products are already out released, and you know, he says a lot of the same sorts of things that many of us computer users say. He says the products aren't usable, they're loaded with features that don't make a lot of sense, the features that are there are accessible 5-6 different ways, and it's not clear what's going on. He complains about some of the terminology used is not clear. The same sorts of things that you or I or, you know, your average office Windows user might complain about. So I just wonder if maybe he's been in this role, this sort of diminished role, for about 7-8 years now. I just wonder if he'd been a Steve Jobs, and not stepped back, but actually had you know, gotten closer to it and almost become a micromanager, whether Microsoft today would be in a stronger position maybe than they're in. Don't get me wrong, they're in a strong position financially. They're a very successful company, and everybody who bashes them forgets that they are still the biggest software company on the planet.
Yes.
But, you know, perceptually, you know, they have an image problem at the moment. The image is that the software is complicated, it's buggy, it's insecure, and it's not really what people want. And Vista in particular has that problem. And I just wonder if Bill had been closer to the company over the last few years, maybe some of the mistakes and the faux pas they've made, they might not have made, because he would have steered them away from them.
I have one of the questions that I've got, and I've had for a while, especially with Microsoft looking to kind of absorb Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo has, in my opinion, and who am I to say, but it's my radio show, so I'm going to. I think Yahoo has kind of an identity crisis going on. They don't really know what they do or where they want to go. They're not going to win in search. They're not going to win in advertising. For some people, they're number two in both, but for a lot of people, they don't seem to think that that's good enough, especially if you're a stockholder.
Yeah.
What does Microsoft do? What does that brand mean? And what does Yahoo's brand mean, and how would those two companies merge?
I think it would have been a disaster, to be honest. I think the kindest thing that could have happened to both of them is for the deal to fall through in the way it has.
Don't you think Yahoo would have just been a name? It would have just been the name Yahoo, but it really wouldn't have meant anything anymore?
I think that actually what it would have, it would have been a marriage of mediocrity. I think
there's your headline for the show.
I think the problems you pointed out with Yahoo, which I completely agree with, is they have no direction. They don't have a strategy. What they've basically done is they've snapped up some big names over the past few years in the hope that one of them will spontaneously morph into a new direction for the company. Obviously, you know, when they first started, they were very big in search and finding things on the web, and they allowed Google to take that away from them. And since then, they've not really had any idea what to do. So they've acquired Flickr and people like that, and
they haven't done anything with Flickr.
They haven't done anything with them.
No.
Now I think Microsoft has exactly the same problem. Microsoft doesn't know it. I mean, its core business, which is operating systems. Enterprise systems like Windows servers, and then the Office products.
And don't forget their entertainment brand, the Xbox.
But the thing with the entertainment brand is not making them a lot of money. The cash cow is operating system, it's Office, and it's their enterprise stuff like Exchange. But the problem with those three sort of lines is that the market for those is finite, and they have pretty much saturated that market, so it's very difficult for them to grow. And I think this is why Microsoft's stock is actually fairly flat, because they can't really take a bite into new markets and expand into them, which is kind of what stock investors are looking for them to do to drive new investment. So they're also trying to find something new to do, and I think the reason they're so desperate to acquire somebody like Yahoo is because they think what they want to do is actually push into Google space and you know, take things out onto the internet and take their business model and push it out onto the internet. And so that's why they've been so keen to grab somebody like Yahoo. And this latest deal isn't the first time they've tried to do it. Again, the problem is that they're expecting, just by acquiring a company like Yahoo, that some sort of new strategy will just spontaneously bubble up out of the acquisition. And again, I don't think that would have happened. So what would have happened is effectively they would have merged the companies together. All the best engineers would have left. Yeah. And then you would have been left with, as you say, with a brand name, a shell of a company, no innovation and no real strategy. And everyone would have said, well, why did they drop all this money into, you know, I mean, it was a colossal sum of money they were offering for Yahoo. And one of the things that Microsoft has in its favor is it does have that very large cash reserve. Now, Apple has that too, and I think really what companies in Silicon Valley should be thinking about nowadays is not looking to do large acquisitions, because I think the next few years are going to be tough for everybody, and they need those cash reserves to make sure the company continues to... Yeah, stays afloat and continues
to... Well, I don't think Apple has to worry about that with cash flow. I think that... with Macintosh sales going up while the rest of the PC industry is going down, with iPod sales, they don't look like they're slowing down at all. They're still doing well. And now with the iPhone, and, oh, by the way, applications for the iPhone, and, oh, yeah, by the way, they sell music too. Yeah. I don't think Apple's going to – I think they're going to be able to weather this recession as it comes up better than Microsoft or Yahoo.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they've been very clever to diversify what they offer and not be stuck with just one offering that can be hit by the downturn. But if the downturn sort of hits everything generally and takes the bottom lines down, then you know, you want those cash reserves to be able to make sure that you can continue to pay your top innovators in the company, and they don't want to go and leave and do their own thing. So it's important to have that. And also, you know, you want to keep your research and development going, and obviously R&D is expensive. So the fact that they've got the cash reserves to do that leaves them in a strong position, and hopefully they will continue to go from strength to strength. Now, Microsoft also is in that strong position. They have the same, well, obviously a much larger cash reserve in proportion, but they wouldn't have done had they bought Yahoo.
No.
And I actually think...
They had to borrow money to buy a Yahoo.
Exactly. So I think had the deal gone through with a lack of strategy and then a downturn in the market, you know, if PC sales go down, then obviously their income goes down, because a big portion of their income is, you know, comes from those Windows licenses on PCs. So they're pretty tied to the volatility of the PC market. And I'm seeing with my clients in my consultancy work, they're already looking long and hard at their server spends over the next 2 to 3 years, because they're thinking they're going to have to tighten their belts. So they're trying to sweat their assets a bit more. So that means that server licensing might be going down as well.
And
so,
as we know, Vista's not lighting the world on fire. In fact, there was a big news story this week that Intel has decided not to migrate to Windows Vista. They're sticking with XP. What does that do to Microsoft? And what's that do to the consumer, the average consumer who may read something like that, that a company like Intel, who supplies the chips for the computers that are running Vista, they're not even going to upgrade to it? Are we really have to look forward to what, Windows 8 or 9, whatever the next one coming out is?
I suspect what they will do is they will push the next
Windows
version.
Windows 7.
Windows 7. They'll push that up in the schedule just to get something that's different from the tarnished product out.
What could Windows 7 really bring to the table? That, is it just going to be all the features that were scrapped from Vista?
I think if they get into this, I think there's a problem with Microsoft is that they have this attitude that stuff more features in and that's what's going to make it great, that's what's going to make it the big seller. And what they fail to realize, and something that I think Apple do understand, is that, I mean, you look at XP, what people like about XP is the fact that it is so old and stable and it's a known quantity, they understand it. One of the problems they had with Vista is it was such a radical departure, I think. You know, and whereas underneath people could see it was virtually the same, but it had all this gloss on top, and that gloss took an extra 20-30% of system resources. People were saying, well, what, this doesn't give me any advantage at all. It looks a bit prettier, but I need a faster PC to use the same programs I was working with on XP last week.
Well, don't you think a lot of Apple people were saying the same thing when, say, Leopard shipped? They're saying, you know, Tiger does everything that this does except for a few of the glossy features.
I think a lot of people said that at the time, but I suspect you talk to a lot of people now, and certainly this is my view, is that there are some key features in Leopard that are, you know, they are very useful to have, and you kind of miss them if you have to go back to Tiger. I've got a couple of Tiger systems around here, and I you know, I miss Quick Look incredibly badly when I go back to Tiger. And, you know, Time Machine as well. In fact, I've just had a a disk error on my main machine, my MacBook, and it was very reassuring to know that, I had a Time Machine backup from last night, because I remember seeing the Time Machine icon running last night before I powered the machine down for the evening. So when I had a system failure today, and it looked like really there was something wrong with the disk, and I ran Drive Genius on it, and Drive Genius couldn't repair it, I thought to myself, well, I don't need to devote any more time to this. I can just wipe the disk, reinstall Leopard, do a full format, and then get my system back from Time Machine. That, you know, you couldn't have done that with Tiger, and I probably wouldn't have had the discipline to have that close of a backup of the system.
Do you think Macintosh users are just generally more forgiving of change than the average PC user, though? I think there's more of a trust with Mac users, with Apple, when something new comes out that it's not going to hose everything, that it's going to be some really cool stuff that they're going to enjoy in there, and it's worth $129, whereas most Microsoft users don't think in those terms. They think, oh, this is, I don't know, is it going to break everything because of the problems they've had in the past?
Yeah, the real problem Microsoft has with Windows versions is drivers. You know, they normally change something in the driver model with every version, and that breaks things, and it's frustrating when you have, you know, a piece of hardware that you paid for and you can't use it because you've updated your OS and the supplier of the hardware has not updated the drivers. Obviously, Apple has much more control over that, so you tend to get fewer problems. But really, I mean, I've found with Tiger, from Panther to Tiger and Tiger to Leopard, there's been a series of incompatibilities, and I don't think that's any different than you get with the Windows versions, really.
Do you think that's just better planning on Apple's part?
I think it's more of a case that people and perhaps in the Mac community can be a little bit more forgiving. I think it's a case of, you know, when it happens with Microsoft, they kind of, you know, blame Microsoft a lot more than they blame Apple.
Now, when you talk about drivers, that's not really Microsoft's fault. It's the third party developers out there. That happens with Apple products too, but it seems like the vast majority of third party companies that are supplying either, you know, whatever it happens to be to Apple Macintosh customers, they seem to be a little bit more on the ball to upgrade their product than the average Microsoft customer or vendor is.
You're dealing with a much smaller market, and so maybe in the Mac community the driver writers appreciate that when a new OS comes out, you know, a very good proportion of their market will upgrade straight away, so they need to have the drivers ready. Whereas in the Windows environment, you know, if you've got, I don't know, whatever it is now, 2 billion machines out there, you know that, you know, only a small percentage of those will be upgrading on day one, and so you can say, well, I can afford to spend 6 months, 8 months before I get around to writing new drivers. So perhaps it's some sort of attitude like that. I don't know whether that's laziness or whether that's a conscious business decision to, you know, not spend the development time to develop the new drivers till later on. But it does certainly seem to be a problem. I know that Microsoft spends an enormous amount of time and money trying to convince drivers to be written for when they, you know, when they release these. There was a lot of talk with Vista that they'd done a very good job on making sure the drivers had been resolved. But I remember hearing on the first week of the Vista launch that there was even some Microsoft products that didn't have updated Vista drivers,
yeah,
and didn't work under Vista. So, you know, they kind of failed in that respect.
Were you following the internal staff email thread about Rich Lefko was looking for a font?
Yes. Yeah,
I thought this was a kind of an amusing story. I thought I'd share it with the listeners. So we do have an internal email staff list, a couple actually, one that's off topic. You could talk about whatever you want. And then another one that's supposedly about Macs and my Mac in general. And so Rich Lefko, he's been on the podcast a number of times, is looking for this font. And he can't find it anywhere. And it's supposed to say that the font, it's supposed to be on the MS Office CD, and it's a free font. So he pulls out his MS Office CD, which he actually won on this podcast before he was a staff member, and he can't find this font anywhere. And Roger Bourne's looking for him, Dan Robinson. There's a number of people that's kind of searching for this font. Nobody can seem to find it. He finds it online, but it's for sale, even though it should be a free font. So I just went up to do a spotlight search for that font after I read his email. I had a copy of this font. The funny thing was, this font was with a Star Wars game from, you know, 2001 or 2002 that's still on my hard drive that I probably haven't played in years, but it's kind of migrated from machine to machine with me. And there was the font. So I just, I stuffed it. I did a, you know, I zipped it and then I sent it to him. I thought that was kind of funny that, you know, there's the font.
Yeah, particularly some of the staff members had spent $10,000 on their font collection and were very miffed. Yeah, very miffed they couldn't find it.
Yeah, and then here it is. I've got it. It's part of this game, and I just, you know, dragged. I did a option drag to my desktop to make a copy, and you know, zipped it and sent it, and there it is.
And I have to say, as somebody who's a more recent Mac convert, I don't understand having a $10,000 font collection.
Well,
I know it's always been a Mac thing that you have lots of fonts kind of hanging
yes
around.
Yes, and that probably stems from the fact that many of the early Mac users and adoptees were graphic artists.
Right.
And coming from, you know, I worked for a design firm for almost 5 years. Coming from that background, I can totally understand why so many fonts exist and why they're very popular in the Mac world. When you're designing something and you have a client, you have to find exactly the right font that matches what they imagined in their head. So you can literally go through hundreds of different fonts before the client says, yes, that's the one. And as a designer, you also want just the right font. And there's a lot of difference between fonts that you think, well, that looks very similar. What's the difference? Well, there are differences. You know, this one might have the Y starting a little higher, or it might dip lower than you want it to. And capital letters, you know, it doesn't quite look right in this font, but it looks better in this font. So the problem with that, though, is that font management has always been kind of a pain, not just on Macs, but on PCs, too.
Yeah.
And I don't think Mac OS X has helped that at all, because there's so many different places that you can find fonts now. Some applications, like this Star Wars game, uses its own fonts that's found in the applications bundle.
Yeah.
You have your user fonts. You have the system-wide fonts. It's crazy. Now, there's a lot of software titles out there that will allow you to manage your fonts, but I don't think any of them particularly work super well. And fonts get corrupt really, really quickly. So font management, I still think, is pretty much a nightmare on the Macintosh. But that being said, I understand why somebody does have 20,000 fonts.
Yeah. I think on the PC side, there's an awful lot of people who just, they use whatever fonts come with Windows, and then Office installs a few more. And, you know, really beyond Arial and Times New Roman, they, you know, that's probably as far as they go.
Yeah.
Unless they're doing like a, you know, a flyer for school or something like that, they might use Windings or one of the more comic stuff.
But you can always tell when someone's created something on a Windows machine and probably created it on a Macintosh.
Yeah.
You could just look at it and go, ooh, that's just a little bit too generic.
I mean, I can really sympathize with that. We have a lot of standard documents we use at work, and they're very, very conservative in the fonts they use, and they're really quite dull. And I have sort of said to a couple of people, a couple of times, you know, really, we're only one step away from typewritten documents here in terms of what we're presenting to our clients. And every now and again, you know, just for fun, I'll mock up a document in Pages and show that to somebody, and they're always blown away by how fantastic it looks.
I was, as you're talking, my email program, which I usually turn off during the podcast, is running, and I just got an email from a David Harrison, spelled incorrectly, by the way, who wants to send me $9,850,000.
Oh, right. That's nice.
So, you know, I think I'm set here.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, he said that he will get me 30% of the total funds. So, you know, he just needs my bank account information. And
oh, that's fantastic.
So
I mean,
I think I'm going to be able to retire here real soon. And
In fact, the phishing stuff has been kind of going a bit crazy recently. I did get one, I think it was yesterday, and I was amazed by how barefaced it was. I mean, normally these things are, you know, they're quite,
A little bit clever.
Yeah, well, they're either clever in terms of, you know, they've made it look like something that's quite, you know, that something it's not. So it looks like it's an official PayPal or eBay or from your bank communication. And you really have to read it quite carefully to see the bad English that actually gives the game away. And you might have to, if it's got links in it, you might have to look at the code behind the links to see where it's actually going. But this one was, I mean, it was dressed up to look like a PayPal email. Mm. And it basically said, you need to reconfirm your bank account details for your PayPal account, otherwise we're going to suspend it. And so it said, what you need to do is you need to send two amounts, one of $14.51 and another of $21.25 to this. And it basically just had this guy's name, bank account details in the email. And you just it was just basically saying, just PayPal me this money and I'll PayPal it straight back to you. And that will, you know, I'm an agent for PayPal and that will confirm. And I thought, you know, this is really like unsophisticated. This is like one step away from, you know, begging. It's basically just send me some money. Don't worry, I work for PayPal.
With an idea years ago that I was going to start a website. And all I was going to do is say, if you read this website, please send me $1. You don't get anything in return, but I will put your name on this page. It'd be a list of contributors. And I want to see how much money I can make on the internet from people just giving me $1. I figured I would have made like $3, so it wasn't worth my time to make the page. But we should make it clear to those who are unsophisticated with email and is pretty new to computers in general, which probably isn't the majority of our listeners, but there are going to be some of those people out there that they've never listened to a podcast. This is the first one they ever heard, and they're new to computers. Your bank will never email you asking for anything. If you are a PayPal member, you will never get something from PayPal saying your account's going to be suspended. Yeah. And even if you do, and it is something legitimate, there's never a link in the email to click to go to their page.
Yeah.
No real business will ever ask you any kind of account information, any kind of personal information, anything like that. It's all scams. It's all to try to separate you from your money. So yeah. Let's throw that out there. Before we wrap up this week, go ahead.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, there has been talk this week of a Mac Trojan. That's been discovered. There's apparently a flaw in the way the Apple Remote Desktop Agent works, which is in Leopard, the technology that allows you to share screens and take control of other Macs on your network. The agent that works like that underneath, apparently, when it will run Apple scripts in root mode, so it will give full access to the machine, and theoretically that could take control of your machine, install malware, or delete files or something like that. So again, something else to reinforce is that any time you're sent anything in an email from somebody you don't know, or even if it's from somebody you do know, but it has any sort of program or link in it that says, oh, click on this, it's really funny, and that sort of the other, just be very, very careful. And my attitude to anything like that is rather than click on a link in an email, I would always take a good look at the link, and really, if I think if it's something legitimate, then I would probably not click on the link, but actually type the URL into a browser rather than click on the link, because you never know where that link's going to take you and what it might do on your machine.
One of the things David and I were talking about before the show started recording the show, and we wanted to discuss on the show, is old computer games. Now, of course, you're relatively new to the Mac,
yeah.
But you're not relatively new to computers.
No, not by a long shot.
So did you play a lot of computer games back in the day or currently?
Oh, yeah.
Or?
I mean, my first computer was a Sinclair machine called the ZX81, which was sold in the U.S. as a Timex T1000, I think. Yeah, Timex Sinclair T1000. So that was, it was a very, very, this was 1981, so it's a very basic computer, but it had, you know, a very large black and white pixel display that was displayed on a TV. And, you know, these pixels were quite, you know, really quite large. It probably only did about sort of 50 by 50 screen. But there was the first game I ever played on a computer. was on there was a game called 3D Monster Maze. Considering how primitive the computer was, it actually looked quite good. And the idea was you would just sort of tromp around this maze in three dimensions. So it was kind of like being in a typical maze sort of thing you might find in Doom.
Yeah.
And there was a T-Rex in there. and you had to make sure that you found the exit to the maze before the T-Rex found you. And if this thing actually, I mean, this computer, the ZX81, didn't have any sound at all. so you were playing this game completely in silence, and when the T-Rex actually came at you, it would get closer and closer, and then the mouth would get bigger, and you were trying to run away in these big one-block jumps around this maze. despite the fact that the graphics were really extremely primitive, it was quite tense.
A similar situation. Of course, I started with console gaming, Atari 2600 and those type of things, arcades. Yeah. But the first game that I ever really played on a computer, a friend of mine had a TRS-80. Mm-hmm. And he had this game called The Dungeons of Daggerath. And it was, everything was white lines. So you're walking down these dungeons and the walls and the floor are just a white line. It's kind of an outline.
Yeah.
And they had these, one of the things was a spider. You couldn't see yourself. It was first person. And to attack, you would say, like, attack, left hand. You would have to equip yourself with various weapons that you found in the game. There was no save, so you would definitely spend a lot of time trying to beat the game. I mean, it would take hours and hours and hours. But it did have sound. Very, very primitive sound, but it did have sound. If you were hurt, it would show your little heart meter. And you could literally see it starting to speed up. It was one of those games that, to me, was just, it was fantastic. It gave me the creeps sitting there at, I was like, 11 years old or something, at my friend's house, 12 years old, playing this game at night, 11 o'clock at night, which when you're young, that's pretty late when you're young.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you're playing this game, and you're going after the wizard, and the graphics, as crappy as they were, it lent itself very, very well to what it was.
Yeah,
and I would encourage anybody just do a Google image search for Dungeons of Daggerath, Daggorath.
Funnily enough, actually, if you look at the Wikipedia page for 3D Monster Maze. Mm-hmm. It'll tell you all about that. There's a couple of screenshots on there. And at the bottom it says, see also Dungeons of Daggerath. So,
well, if you do a quick search for Dungeons of Daggerath, you'll actually see it. You go through doors.
Yeah.
And the graphics really weren't that bad for what it was. And I bring this up because I had these very fond memories of this game that I loved it so much. So a few years ago when Chad Perry and I did the Mac mod, that video where we took an Atari 2600, and we turned it into a Macintosh computer, which, you, by the way, anybody can watch if they go up to mymac.com and click the video link at the top of the page. We had did that video, and somebody who watched it and was a fan of the MyMac website thought it would be cool if we did the same thing but with a TRS-80. So this person sent me a TRS-80.
Wow.
And it was brand new, David, in the box.
Wow.
And the box had been opened, and he had pulled it out of the shrink wrap and put it back in, but it had never been turned on. It had the little connector. You remember that you had to put on the back of your TV to switch from video game to TV?
Yeah.
It came with that, and I was so excited to get it because it was practically a brand new computer. It's still in the same condition. I did hook it up. But I jumped on eBay, and it took me a long time to figure out what this game was, Dungeons of Daggerath, because I remember the game, and I knew it was Dungeons or something like that, but I couldn't figure out what game this was. I finally found it on eBay, and I bought it for 50 cents plus, like, $5 shipping and handling.
Yeah.
I get it in the mail, like, a week and a half later. Hooking up the TRS-80, by the way, to my HDTV was definitely not the easiest thing in the world to do. But I did get it hooked up, and it looked fairly decent, I guess. It probably would have looked better if I had hooked it up to, like, an old TV. And I popped this game in, didn't even bother to read the instructions. I thought I remembered how to play it, and I didn't. But it was just so primitive and so crappy looking. I thought, why did I think this was so great? You know, I think sometimes nostalgic should stay nostalgic. Don't bring it to the future because it doesn't hold up.
I think the problem with nostalgia is, particularly with games, is that, because I've done this a few times where you get, I mean, the old arcade games I used to play, you know, I used to hit the arcades pretty big time in the early 80s. And of course with MAME and stuff like that now, you can play them on your Mac or your PC, no problem at all. And if you know where to look, you can find the ROMs, so you can revisit all those old arcade games and play them in your own home. And they're never as good as you remember. And the reason is that the gameplay is often not as intense as you thought it was. The graphics obviously look pretty primitive by today's standards, and it's very difficult if you're used to playing games on a PS3 or an Xbox 360 or even a Nintendo DS or a PSP to then go back, you know, 10-15 years to the way the computing power was available then. These machines were incredibly limited in terms of it wasn't so much the graphic displays, but it was the amount of memory the programmers had available. I mean, Daggerath ran in 8K, I think.
Yeah.
You know, 3D Monster Maze ran in 16K on the ZX81. 16 kilobits, that is, not 16 megabytes. That's 16 kilobits. That's a tiny, tiny amount of RAM. So, you know, there wasn't the scope to build a lot of functionality into the games. And really, it's amazing how much they could do. I mean, one of my favorite games in the 80s was a game that originally came out on the BBC Micro. And the BBC Micro was an 8-bit computer that was kind of the equivalent, the British equivalent of probably the Apple II. It was called the BBC Micro because it was developed by Acorn Computers in conjunction with the BBC. They part-funded it. And the idea was that they would help the development of the computer, and then they did a whole series of programs about home computing that used this as a platform so that you could run software that they showed on the TV shows and that sort of thing. It was kind of like, you know, an educational type project.
Sure.
And so, a lot of schools bought an awful lot of these BBC Micros. And, you know, they were pretty good machines for the day. They had sound, they had good color, they had some quite high-res modes if you went to black and white. And they were very, very expandable. You could get extra processors, you could get disk drives, you could get all sorts of things. And you know, they had ROM chips and all sorts of stuff you could do. And really very similar in concept to the Apple II. And one of my favorite games on that, which was amazing when I first saw it, was a game called Elite.
Mm.
Now, I don't know whether Elite particularly made it ever big in the US, but in the UK, Elite was absolutely massive. And what it was a space simulation where you were a cargo trade. You had your own cargo ship, and you just went from galaxy to galaxy. There was about 8 galaxies and hundreds of planets in this game, and at least 40 or 50 different models of ship. And you would basically buy cargo and then trade it in different systems. And effectively, you played the game as if you were actually living in this world. Everything was presented in 3D graphics, pretty good 3D graphics for the day. And you know, you had this very large open-ended gameplay where you could, there were missions and there were things you could do to try and you know, the reason the game was called Elite was because it would actually rate you on the amount of battles you'd had and the amount of ships you'd defeated, and the more you defeated, the more you went up the ratings. You started as as harmless as your rating, and then you went from there to mostly harmless, and then you were poor, and then you were average, and then you were above average, and then became competent, and then you really started to go up the rankings, and then eventually became elite. And if you got to elite, that meant you were badass. I mean, you know, that meant you killed hundreds of thousands of ships virtually through playing this game. And this thing was the very first time sink. I mean, I put hundreds of hours into playing Elite and going from galaxy to galaxy trading. And of course, you would you would trade cargo to make more money so you could upgrade the systems on your ships, which made it easy to fight. This game was written and ran in 32K of RAM on the BBC Micro.
It's amazing what they could do back in the day with such limitations, but
yeah.
When the limitations are the average and the norm, you're not really missing anything. You
know? That game was developed by two guys as well. I mean,
That's not surprising, though.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the best stuff out there started very small. And then, of course, you look no further than Apple Computer. Started with two guys, and look where they're at now.
Yeah.
Really three guys, but generally speaking, the two Steves.
But sometimes, you know, you play today's games. I mean, I'm playing Crisis Core Final Fantasy VII on the PSP at the moment, and it is amazing. I mean, it's like playing an interactive movie, a cartoon movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, it must have cost millions to develop with all the cutscenes and the voice acting and all of that, you know, for a game that, you know, I'll probably get 20, 30 hours out of until I finish it at best.
Yeah.
And then it will go on the pile and it will probably never get looked at again.
Yeah, I've got a huge pile of Wii games that fit that category, unfortunately. A lot of PS2, a lot of... You know, the funny thing is, there seems to be kind of a resurgence in Mac games right now.
Mm.
And from everything I'm reading online, there isn't a resurgence in PC games. That a lot of PC game companies have gone away, or they're making games for consoles now because there's such a movement of piracy out there that they can't make any money. You know, they sold 400,000 copies of a certain game, but they see there's 3 or 4 million different people playing online every day. They're like, hey, wait a minute. You know, the vast majority of these people are pirators. They didn't pay for this game, and that's just not right. Is there any Mac games that you were into? Or you kind of came into Mac late enough that you didn't get into
Everyone goes on the Mac Marathon, and I've played Marathon since I got a Mac, but it didn't really excite me, I'm going to be honest. But again, it's the thing is that, you know, Marathon compared to, you know, a 3D shooter nowadays is not quite the same thing. I don't think there's anything really in the Mac side that I can point to and say, you know, that was really a big thing for me.
I can do that with a couple different games. For me, one of the first games that I really got hooked on with the Mac was Warcraft and Warcraft 2. There was something about those games that just really, really sucked me in.
Mm-hmm.
But as much as I like the Warcraft series, I'm not into the big multiplayer thing that they have now.
Yeah.
The one that really hooked me was StarCraft.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited about the new StarCraft coming out, and I've been on Blizzard's PR list since, well, for like 12, 13 years now. So I know they'll probably send a copy to me, and if they don't, I'll go out and buy it. But the funny thing was, when StarCraft was announced, it was just, at least on the Mac side, I didn't follow the PC side so much, but on the Mac side, there was just so much anticipation for this game.
Yeah.
Mac users were dying to get their hands on it. Well, Blizzard had actually sent me a pre-release copy a year before the game came out.
Wow.
And I posted two separate first look type of articles of StarCraft II a year before this game came out. And I tell you, other than tech type of articles, I never got as much email as I did when I posted that.
Yeah.
People were just clamoring for this. People were offering me hundreds of dollars to make a copy and send them a copy. And, of course, I didn't. But I found it amazing that so many people were just chomping at the bit to get this game. And to be quite honest, I still play StarCraft occasionally. I will still break this game out. I don't play it online because the people that play it online are so freaking good they'll kill me in no time at all. But I remember setting up local LANs to play against friends of mine, and it was just a great time. It was just so much fun. There was another game called Rune that I also got into.
Rune, what sort of game was that? What's style?
You're kind of Vikings, and they kind of had powers a little bit, but it was more of a third person walking around in these different environments and killing each other.
Yeah.
We were playing that company that I was talking about earlier, about the graphic design firm.
Mm-hmm.
We all got into Rune, a good six or seven of us.
Yeah.
We would play it over the network at lunchtime. And this game was pretty gory. I mean, it was, you know... the best weapons were swords. That's all you had, really, axes and swords. But there was like one or two swords that were really badass that would kill somebody in like one hit. But my fondest memory was when I was introducing this game to the people at work, and they were all like, oh, that's so cool. I was showing this one guy named Greg, and I said, I'm getting pretty good at this, man. You guys are going to have to play this. And they got into it so much that they were actually playing from home against each other over the internet.
Yeah.
And not so much me. I was doing so many other things. So I'm telling Greg how good I am at this game. I fire it up. I go online. It was lunchtime at work. And I find this map. There's only one guy in it. So I think, well, I'll fight him real quick, and I'll probably kick his butt. So there's this bridge, and I'm on this bridge, and he's on the other side of it. And I didn't know how to do these little gestures to like, taunt the other player.
Yeah.
But he obviously did, because he made the thumb across the neck, I'm going to kill you kind of gesture. And Greg was like, oh, that's cool. And I'm like, oh, this guy thinks he's, Barney Badass. Watch this. So we come running at each other. Swipe, I'm dead.
Wow.
Cuts my head right off. And, of course, it takes, 5 seconds to respawn. So you're sitting there looking at the guy that just killed you and your dead body, and he picks up my head and starts using it as a soccer ball. And Greg just fell out of his chair literally laughing so hard after I was talking, oh, I'm getting good at this, and there's this guy using my head as a... Oh, it was so embarrassing.
I think nowadays they would call that pwned, wouldn't they?
Yeah, probably. But, but I didn't care because it was so much fun.
Yeah.
But I've got a lot of stories on Warcraft 2 and Starcraft that I could fill a whole podcast talking about these old games and some of the battles that I had.
It's interesting what you say about StarCraft. I never played StarCraft very much. I played quite a lot of Command & Conquer.
I didn't like Command & Conquer as much simply because the characters on screen were so small.
Yeah.
That it was so much easier to control the StarCraft or the Warcraft characters. And they had more of a personality, whereas in Command & Conquer, they were just like...
Kind of like sprites, really, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, in Warcraft 2... Because, you can click the character on screen and, tell them what you want them to do. But one of the peons, I don't remember if it was the humans or, it was the humans. If you kept repeatedly clicking on one of the peons, the first time he'd say, yes, my lord. Then you click him up again and he'd say, what? Yes, my lord, what? And he'd go through that a couple times. And if you kept clicking him, he would say, stop touching me. Will you quit clicking me? And stuff like that. It was just, it was just little bits of humor like that that Blizzard puts into their games that really sets them apart from a lot of the other game publishers out there.
I think it's interesting you say that about Blizzard. I mean, the games they make are always very innovative. They always put a lot of stuff like that in. I played a lot of Diablo and Diablo 2. Fantastic games, those. If you like, you're into the medieval hack and slash type. I played
a lot of Diablo and Diablo 2 on the Macintosh.
Yeah,
that was another one that I got. Because it was Blizzard, I got those copies of those games.
Yeah,
I never got into the Diablo thing like a lot of other people did.
No, I think it was kind of an early World of Warcraft because online people got pretty crazy about Diablo 2 particularly.
There's a lot of cheating going on in that game as well.
That's right. Yeah, that was the first one where people were really hacking into it, wasn't it? But the thing with Blizzard games is that they've always released their games simultaneously for PC and Mac.
But it's usually pretty close.
Yeah, and an awful lot of the games actually come with the PC and Mac versions on the same CDs.
Well, Blizzard has a thing right now. You can actually buy some of their older games, and they're fully compatible with the new Mac OS X and Vista. You can buy them online now. You don't have to have the disc like you used to.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times that I've decided I feel like playing StarCraft, but I can't play the expansion of StarCraft because I lost that disc years ago.
So I actually have the original. Yeah. So I have probably two or three copies of Diablo 2.
because
it's kind of, you've lost one of the discs, it's just easy to go out and buy it again,
and they're dirt cheap.
Yeah, exactly. So
buy them all just for next to nothing.
But the reason I mention that is that one of the things that frustrates me about the current state of Mac gaming is that a lot of the games are being brought over to the Mac.
Wine.
But yeah, by effectively via these emulation technologies,
yep.
They don't perform as well on the Mac.
Nope.
They typically don't run on the MacBook or the Mac Minis because of the lower end graphics in those, mm-hmm. which is irritating because if you actually put the things into boot camp and run the Windows versions of the games, they actually run fine on those machines. What I appreciate about what Blizzard do is they actually develop from the ground up for the Mac. And develop from the ground up for the PC, and that's two separate development lines. And rather than develop for one, then port it to the other.
Well, they are under emulation. A much bigger company now. They got kind of purchased by Vivendi, and so they're like the number two game publisher as far as size goes. So I'm really interested to see what they do with StarCraft II. I'm going to buy it. It's going to be probably the first computer or Mac game that I've been looking forward to for a long, long time. The other one is probably Spore. I did download the demo of the Spore Creature Creator. I don't know if you've got a copy of that yet.
No, I haven't looked at it.
It's limited. I mean, there's only so much you can do with it, but it's also kind of fun. The sponsor for this week's podcast, of course, is Otherworld Computing. And, David, you picked the product this week from...
We'll put a link to this in the show notes, but this is a product that I think is... Everybody who has an iPod or an iPhone should think about getting one of these. It's from a company called NLU, and it's the Bodyguards line. The one that specifically we've got the link for is the Bodyguards for the iPhone.
And we've actually reviewed this product in the past, and it got really high marks at MyMac.
Yeah, we have, and the reason it consistently gets high marks is of this type of product. I think the NLU version is probably the best one that you can get. Effectively, what it is, it's the same material. It's like a 3M film that you often see on the front of cars to protect them from scratches from stone chips, and it's incredibly tough plastic, but it's completely optically transparent. And it's pretty easy to apply. And what NLU have done is they'll sell you a pack that gives you a squeegee, some liquid for actually applying it to your iPhone, and two sets of the film. So you can either do two iPhones, or if you're worried that you might get might not do it very well the first time, then you can have a go and then take it off and then do it again with the second one and really get a good finish.
Yeah.
And this stuff, you'll see videos of it on the internet. You could try and pierce it with knives and screwdrivers, and it just won't tear. So if you put that on your iPhone, then doesn't really matter how rough you are with your iPhone in terms of putting it into bags or pockets with other items, it just won't get scratched because effectively 95% of the surface of the phone is covered by this film. Once it's on there, you get a very slight ripple effect in the if you look at the screen of the iPhone when there's a light shining on it. But as soon as you're actually using the iPhone for anything, you can't really see the film at all. You get fantastic protection, and you also get this situation where the film gives you a slightly better grip, so you don't tend to drop the iPhone as often as you might do if it's completely unprotected.
I dropped my iPhone today for the very first time.
Yeah,
I went to set it down, and I actually set it on my wallet, and it wasn't closed all the way, and it slid right off onto the floor.
Yeah. Now, obviously, the only thing the film can't do is protect it from, a physical hit. So if you drop it on concrete, then you might break something in the iPhone. But what you won't do is scratch the iPhone. for the cost of this stuff, which is $20 for two sets of film, I think you can't really go wrong.
And you'll find that link under the show notes for podcast 190. Wow, we're only 10 shows away from our 200th episode. Still not sure what we're going to do for that episode, but it's coming up. Some changes on the podcast coming up. We're going to have to record it on a different night, so we're not going to be releasing the podcast on Friday mornings anymore. That's because I did take a job. It's kind of a software developer type of position. It's 2 hours away, which means I'm going to be commuting 4 hours a day. And that means that I'm not going to be home most of the time, I would imagine, at the time that we record the podcast. That may change. I don't know. But so I'm still not sure what time we're going to record the podcast next week, David.
But, right.
We'll figure it out. We'll work it out. I would prefer to do it around the same time. But if we have to move it up, we have to move it up. If we have to move it to a different day, I don't think it's going to affect the quality of our podcast, though, unless I'm so tired that I can't speak. I thought about breaking out the flip video camera, getting one of those little tripods that you can put on the dash of your car and doing a little video cast from the car occasionally. That might be fun.
Yeah.
Nice if I can actually stream video from the iPhone going down the road. That'd be kind of neat. You can see me kill myself in the car accident because I wasn't paying attention. Some of the latest goings on up at MyMac Magazine's website, MyMac.com. I did a review, I don't know if you read this or not, David, from LapLogic called the G800 Aerogel Extreme.
Yeah, it looked quite interesting.
I find that, you know, I've reviewed and I've looked at a lot of different laptop stands and, you know, what you put in your lap between your lap and your laptop. This is the one that I like the most so far. Most of them, you have to put these little rubber feet on it so it doesn't slide around. The material of this stand itself doesn't lend itself well to slipping. I mean, it really, really works well. I forget sometimes to crank on the SMC fan control application to boost up my fans to cool the MacBook down. It doesn't matter if I've got the fans on full blast or not, because this thing really does, it keeps the heat away from my lap, and that's really the most important part. And it doesn't slip. I like it. It's kind of expensive. It's like $70, but I think it's worth it. It's really nice.
It's at the aerogel material. I mean, it's really space-age stuff. It's quite cutting edge.
I do question what kind of aerogel is in there, because I know for a fact that aerogel is extremely, extremely expensive.
Mm.
So when they use that term aerogel, I kind of wonder what to be honest, I'd rather rip this thing apart to get the aerogel out to play with it because it's so cool.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It says aerogel, so I'm going to assume it's in there, but if it was real aerogel, these things would cost like $300. So
right.
I don't know. David Weeks did two Glenn Fleshman books of the Take Control series. Donnie Inkelo, I'm sorry. This guy named David Cohen. Have you heard of him, David?
Yeah.
He did this Fenestration 42 data exchange in the clouds.
This
is fun making the little blurb for it, the little graphic that we put up on the website. I just use some clouds and zeros and ones.
You're much better
at
that.
So clever.
That sort of thing. It's clever than me because I wouldn't have even thought of that. So,
well, I read your article and I think, what kind of graphic am I going to use on the main page for this?
So
zeros and ones. Data.
So
there we go.
It's talking about the possibility of in the future whether much more of our data will be online and what that might mean if for instance something like Microsoft Office was fully a web app as opposed to a big heavy clunky set of applications you load on your computer.
Do you think it will be Microsoft that does that, or do you think it's going to be a company like Google that's really going to popularize using online applications?
Time will tell. Microsoft has an opportunity to try and go in that direction. I spoke to Google.
Do you think they have the foresight or the foresight to do something like that? I don't think they do. I think they're kind of. I think that Microsoft is more, and this kind of goes back to our earlier conversation. They're more of a music company in regards to they want to keep the same business model that they've been doing for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Even though the rest of the industry is moving away from that business model.
I think there are people at Microsoft who see the opportunities to do something different. And I think one of the problems Microsoft has is that it's not a homogenous organization and you get different factions within there trying to protect their business at the expense of somebody else's innovation. Mm-hmm. So unless the people who are going to be running Microsoft from now on can break through that and actually decide which way things are going to go, then they probably will miss the opportunity. And somebody like Google or maybe even somebody else could take that opportunity away from them. But certainly, I mean, the way I work like that at the moment by putting stuff up on servers and syncing across different machines, it works really well for me.
Long-time MyMac contributor. He was gone for a while, but he's back now. Nate Eaton. A review of the Groove Atomic high performance earphones in the color pink.
These
high performance earphones were really cheap in price, $30, and he only gave them a 2 out of 5. So I think that's pretty much all you need to know about those headphones. And Rich Lefko, who we talked about earlier, did the review of the iRecord, a way to record content for your computer without using your computer. So that's I don't really have a need for a personal media recorder, but a lot of people do. This might be a good solution for them.
Yeah, I know the iRecord's been around for quite a long time.
And that doesn't mean everybody knows about it, too.
No, well, this is the thing. I mean, I think it's struggled to break out of its niche and really hit the big time. It does... One of the advantages of doing this sort of stuff on computers, you have a bit more control, whereas this is kind of a black box solution.
Right.
So, it just really... I think it always depends on your skill level and the amount of effort you want to put into doing a project like this, what sort of device or technology you want to use to make it happen.
Over on the blog side, I posted a blog called, and I was wrong, and I'll admit that. I call it bull. AT&T is not subsidizing the iPhone. Looks like I was absolutely wrong on that, but it did foster a lot of discussion on that blog post, so check that out. It was posted on June 23rd. Same day, I also posted a personal blog called Carlin. As everybody knows, one of my favorite comedians, George Carlin, actually passed away this week. And that really sucks, David. It really, really does. For years and years, he was my favorite living comedian. My favorite comedian of all time was Sam Kittison. Not necessarily for his more explosive content, but for just his delivery. And I really like Sam Kittison. Although his stuff doesn't hold up as well anymore.
No.
But George Carlin, I actually got to see him live in concert. And then as I write in the blog, I was a little disappointed it wasn't as good, because sitting so far away from Carlin, you can hear him, but you can't see the facial expressions, and that's so much a part of his act. But I feel very fortunate, to be honest, that I actually saw Carlin live.
Yeah.
So that's I wish I would have took a camera and taken some pictures, but I didn't.
I think it says a lot for how well regarded he was, is the response that people have had to the fact that he's passed.
He always felt like no matter how bad things were in the world, if we had George Carlin, he was kind of our protector. He was the one person that would completely rip into that subject and make them look foolish in such a way that they didn't have a comeback. And with him not being there, I think it's a big hole in the comedy world, and not just comedy, but in free thinkers. And that's what George Carlin really was. He was a free thinker. Honestly, when I started this podcast and I thought initially about doing interviews with people, he was one of the people that I thought, if I can ever get George Carlin to come on the podcast, I could stop doing the podcast after that and be a happy man, because he's so brilliant. And I looked up to him so much that, when I read that he had died, most of the times you read something about a celebrity passes away and you're like, oh, that's too bad, and then you kind of move on. With Carlin, it's been almost a week now, and I'm still feeling it. I mean, it still really bothers me that he died. I really, really enjoyed him.
Yeah.
So that's about it up on the site right now. There's a couple of the blog posts, and we'll be back next week. I'm not quite sure when the podcast will be released next week. Hopefully we'll have Lee back and Guy Searle. And David, thanks for coming on this week and chatting for over an hour.
That's okay. It was a pleasure.
It was fun for me, too. If you guys have any old Mac games that you want to tell us about, we'd love to hear about it. If you want to send us feedback, you can either send it to tim@mymac.com, or if you want to actually share your story, tell us about this game, tell us some of your history on it, you can actually do that via audio. Pick up your telephone and dial 1-801-938-5559. Tell us about that cool old Mac game you used to play and why it was cool, and hey, maybe even why we should break out an old computer, find it, download it, and play it ourselves. I'm not opposed to that. That'd be kind of fun, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. It'd be great.
Finding some old games and playing it on an old computer, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
So we are out of here, and we'll be back next week. Thanks, David.
Okay.